Money Radio, thank you for joining us today for the review. It is a pleasure now to welcome Virginia Heffernan. She has been a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and she's a writer. You read the new book by Virginia Heffernan, you'll quickly discover that she is indeed a writer. And the new book is entitled Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art, Magic and Loss by Virginia Heffernan. Virginia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sinclair. It's a pleasure to be here and hear a little of that canon rock, Pachelbel's canon, set in a rock arrangement.
Yes, indeed. I thought it would be an appropriate way to start the interview today because it's something that you mention in the book and
That's
refer to
right.
frequently, as a matter of fact.
Yes, I do. That was a revelatory, we're hearing the audio from it, a revelatory video for me when I first saw it in 2006. It's the work of a Korean guitarist named Jeonghyun Lim. He goes by the nom de guerre or, you know, stage name of Funtwo, F-U-N-T-W-O. He posted it to a Korean music site at the, not too far into the millennium. And soon after that, somebody else posted it to YouTube. It shows him playing a guitar, that aggressive finger work we just heard, really doing this very complex thing with strumming through a complete arpeggio. I'm not entirely sure. It's something called sweep picking. At the same time that his fingers are doing all the talking for him, his face is covered by a baseball cap, and it's shot very awkwardly. He's got sun streaming through the room behind him in the video, and something about this video was captivating to me. And in some ways, Magic and Loss, the book, is a book-length effort to put my finger on why I found that video so spellbinding and transformative.
Okay. There is something about that video. You look at it, you see the guy playing away. And part of it is, I think, the realization that 50 years ago, I never would have heard of this young musician, never would have experienced his performance. It would not have existed in my world.
That's right. I mean, and I think that in a way, that that evolution in the culture is dramatized in the video itself. It's a little, it's almost like you sort of look at it like an art critic and see that from the, and I, all your listeners really should go take a look at this thing. It has millions and millions of views on YouTube. You can look it up just under the name Funtwo, F-U-N-T-W-O. From the neck up, he's hidden and shy and not revealed. You can't really see much of him except for his chin, and he looks very young from there down. But from sort of the sternum down, he's like a front man, he's aggressive. And that combination, the idea that on the internet we're both hidden and kind of showing off or showing some dimension of our skills and talents is very interesting to me. And, he wanted us to hear the music, and I did ultimately meet him and talk to him. He wanted us to hear the music, but he also wanted to hide. And that's very different from the musicians, that we were exposed to pre-internet from the 70s, 80s, 90s, who wanted very much to be seen. And the ones that we did, you and I end up seeing pre-internet, were ones who carefully calculated the impression they made on us on MTV and so forth. This was something very different, this performance. And in that little video is contained so much about digital culture. It's almost like I didn't even have to write this book. The video, told the story.
What does that video and what have your subsequent viewings of various videos and various performances and even mundane transactions on the internet lead you to believe that there is magic and art in the internet?
Well, another Thank you. I mean, this is sort of the central question of the book. I will answer by talking about my first experience of networked computers, which was almost accidental. My hometown in New Hampshire installed a giant mainframe computer in the middle of town, and we as school children were given a demo of it, and some of us were just, you know, enthralled by it, and asked our parents, as I did, to get them these terminals where we could use a time-sharing system on this mainframe computer from our houses. Now, on that computer, I was able in 79, 80, 81 to dial into the mainframe and join a kind of proto-chat room. So this is like the age of ARPANET and the EVE networks, and yet here I was as a child pretending or calling myself Athena online and talking to all kinds of different people in that sort of masquerade, you know, social media way that we recognize from today. This is even before the word internet. In any case, I looked at that interface, the green letters, the phosphor letters with the deep, dark background, and I had, you know, a much earlier, much more primitive response to it than I had to the Fun 2 video, but no less, you know, profound, which was I wanted to know what was back there. You know, I stared at that space, the space among and between the letters and words that I was learning to type on the computer, and I wanted to know, you know, who I was talking to or how all this processing power and information was flooding into my life through the phone lines in those days. And to take the measure of what that might be, that deep space. You know, some kids look up at the night sky and that sparks all kinds of questions. I was comparably inspired by that dark space of my first terminal.
And perhaps any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
I love that. Yeah, the Arthur C. Clarke quotation is always, you know, near me. He's a very way out thinker and talker, but that, yeah, there's a certain humanity in that statement. You know, he says it's indistinguishable from magic. He doesn't say it is magic. He just says most human brains are sort of incapable of fully grasping a super advanced technology like network computing, like the internet. And so we can't tell it apart from magic. And magic became, which is a term of art among programmers, magic became, you know, a reasonable working title for what that phenomenon was to me.
And picked up by Apple as well.
That's right. Apple introduced the iPad as a magic and revolutionary device. It was one of Steve Jobs' favorite words. And it does, in programming speak, it does explain code that makes very complicated processes look simple and simple for the end user. You know, if you look at the back-end code, if you stumble into the back-end code for almost anything online, it's pages and pages and pages and sometimes far more than that of symbols. And yet, you know, we can, to the extent that we want to, keep ourselves blissfully unaware of all that complexity and have, you know, simply the right swipe of Tinder or the, you know, up swipe of Pokemon Go or, you know, the few buttons you can press to order food in New York on an app. I mean, the amount of back-end processing there is, you know, is concealed from us, and that concealing is something like the work of a magician.
And art can also be magical, a magical musical performance or a magical play, or you read a book and it can be a magical experience. So this internet,
That's right.
Of it, or at least much of it, is in many ways, though, a very inelegant art, commercial, crass sometimes, frequently very vulgar. It can be silly and stupid, and yet it is incredibly compelling.
Yes. Well, you know, the book is divided into sort of five chapters, and there's a preface, and there's a little bit of a memoir at the end. But the five chapters are what I think of as the building blocks of digital civilization, and indeed the building blocks of any civilization, namely the arts. So, poetry we now think of as text, design, images, photography, and music and film. I'm combining images and photography, so that's why I'm getting to six. I treat all these, and I really want to make the point that by saying that there's a certain component of magic to digital culture, I don't mean, all good. I don't mean all good for our health or morally good, good for civilization, good for one of the, political parties or another, a healing process, the end of poverty. None of those things. Magic is black magic and, good magic and all kinds of tricks. One of the facts of especially the kind of open web, not app mobile culture so much as the web 1.0, the Yahoo interface, the AOL interface, eBay, stuff like that, Match.com, Craigslist, Wikipedia, is that it was a very populist form, and it very much had the legacy of two things. One, the conviction in the early days of the web that information wants to be free or ought to be free, and then the later anxiety that if it was free, how are we all going to make a living? So that the coupling of the first conviction about the liberty, information and liberation, and then the second terror that we were giving away, or people in culture businesses were giving away intellectual property and needed to make some money from it, ended in this design mess. And the web. Sometimes I say in the book that it looks a lot like kind of cities up there when they were most kind of jeopardized. There's like, we have trolls, say, instead of muggers, right? We have there's malware, there's broken links that are like potholes or like infrastructure disrepair. You look at the junky non-design of something like YouTube. There are all these ways that it conspires to like trick you and pick your pocket, get you to give up data you don't want to give up, and you feel like you're in a game online. And believe it or not, this is not to say that I don't have a lot of deep affection for it. Sometimes some people thought living in New York in the 70s was the best time to be there. That there was nothing like graffiti and disco and people trying to make music with turntables and broken drum machines and human beatboxes. And there's a lot of improv on the web that I still really love and appreciate, especially in the old message boards, some of which are still thriving. So I don't think, I guess the end of that is just to say that I don't think that the fact that there are a lot of people, the fact that there is aggressive language and images, the fact that there's pornography, the fact that there's unwanted sound sometimes, the fact that, there's essentially the digital equivalent of horns honking and broken windows and crowds and crime, doesn't mean that it's not magic in some way, that there are not incredibly intellectually fertile corners. You take Twitter, for example. Someone asked me the other day, how can Twitter be art? How can Twitter be poetry? There's so much anger there. Well, what about the word art makes you think that anger is not a part of it, right? Art is emotional.
Good point.
And it's not clean and perfect.
And I do want to follow on that idea of Twitter as poetry. Mm. And we'll do that as we continue our conversation with Virginia Heffernan. This is an intriguing book. It's Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. Magic and Loss by Virginia Heffernan. We'll be back in just a moment. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Review. We're talking with Virginia Heffernan. She's the author of a new book, Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. You were talking about the idea of Twitter as poetry. There has been an idea that we are losing our ability to be literate, although I suppose that there is quite a bit of great poetry that is 140 characters or less. Haiku comes to mind.
That's right.
But what is the other part of the title here? Loss. What have we lost?
Well, first of all, it's Sinclair. I just want to go back to the idea that I'm so glad you have me on the show, because I'm so grateful to get to talk about the internet just for a little bit as something other than a neurotoxin or a scourge or something that is somehow ruining our lives or ushering in a dark ages. With billions of us now using it and the number of cell phone subscriptions almost on par with the number of people on Earth, we are in this collective endeavor together, and I'd like to invite people to use it intentionally and without so much self-hatred.
It's this massive collaboration. It really is unlike anything that we've seen before. So many people have come together to create whatever it is. There's something very beautiful about this incredible collaboration that has occurred.
That's right. In the past, when we've thought about the double-edged sword of technology, of the Industrial Revolution, or of nuclear technology, it's always come from someone else. This is our shared project. And, you know, what I would ask is we work collectively to make it a humane and beautiful and progressive place to live. And I see so many people doing that. And then when I see in the press that it's just treated as a diversion or a way of getting your brain hijacked or ushering in, you know, a period of illiteracy, I feel this cognitive dissonance between what we all see happening and participate in and then the discourse around it. About Twitter as poetry, what we're losing. So there have been times when epic poetry has been in vogue for various reasons, novels with like lots of twists and turns and serialized forms wax and wane. Oh, long form journalism that, you know, really dominated the 60s and 70s is something that hasn't really thrived online. The Kindle has done great things for long novels with lots of twists and turns. You know, you see like the ascendant novelists, Elena Ferrante and Jonathan Franzen and Marilyn Robinson, write really deep, wonderful novels that play beautifully in ebooks. But that long form journalism that lots of us carry a place in our heart for has not done so well online, so that's a loss. And, you know, I'm not sure that people are going to return to epic poetry anytime soon, because we have such an outlet for the short lyric, which is in Twitter. You know, you talk about haikus. Haikus are in Japanese, you know, using the Chinese alphabet and the pictographic alphabet, very few characters, you know, because they're obviously divided by syllables. So one of those would be, you know, a fraction of a tweet. 140 characters, especially in pictographic languages, is a lot. And so, you know, the people to look to as practitioners of the epigram on Twitter, like that super short form thing that I must admit Donald Trump excels at, would be like Emerson or Oscar Wilde or, you know, ages ago, Confucius. Just those short, beautiful, or funny, you know, or surprising twists of the language.
We have barely scratched the surface, but we have run out of time.
As you can see, I'm enthusiastic.
Indeed you are, and that's good. And it is reflected in the book, by the way, Magic and Loss. And I know writers are always looking for pearls in their words. You have managed to string them together into a lovely necklace here. Your language in this book, your writing, is just beautiful and delightful to read, I should say.
Thank you very much, Sinclair. That's such a nice thing to say.
And a topic that is monolithic and perhaps cannot be handled in a book, certainly not in a short conversation as we have just had. But you'll enjoy this book, Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art, by Virginia Heffernan. Magic and Loss. Virginia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks very much.